Welcome to Hallow Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. This study dives into some powerful biblical themes: pride, self-importance, and the need to walk in humility and obedience to God's commands. We explore the account of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11, the prophecy against Ephraim in Isaiah 28, and Paul's parallel teachings in 1 Corinthians 14. The big takeaway from the Torah passage and companion readings is that the Messiah wants to replace our human pride with himself as the true foundation and source of wisdom. It's all about finding that balance, childlike faith combined with mature discernment, leaving behind self-exaltation to humbly submit to the Messiah's lordship.
One of the things I want to bring out to you initially before I go into Isaiah 28 and 1 Corinthians, which both those have very similar themes of instruction as far as guidance is concerned. We have some stuff. I know this is the three-year cycle, but there's actually some similarities to the one-year cycle. coincidentally, again, sometimes that happens. But one of the things I want to focus on is before we go into our Haftarah portion, our New Testament portion, there's some details I want to fill out or flesh out a bit. Those of you who observed or noticed from the Noah and the time of the flood and everything and the people coming out of the flood, one of the objectives God had was to improve, or I should say improve, get rid of, I should say, the horrible or wicked misbehaviors that were around and the people that their violence they were continuously after during prior to the flood, as far as how mankind had reduced themselves down to very basic nature. Well, you'll notice as far as after flood, things changed. Of course, a few things took place. You have obviously the Tower of Babel, which we covered about in this section, as well as the various migrations of humanity as it moved from post-flood world and started to scatter about around the world. What I bring to your attention is that there's some controversial ideas. I hold some, others hold different ones on how this migration stuff took place and what's going on in the world. You'll notice as we go through the following few chapters, Abraham then obviously goes off and goes to Canaan, right? He continues on his migration with Lot and Sarah and their families as far as their travels. And when they get there, there's a famine immediately. They wind up going to Egypt. So in Egypt, there's a bunch of, there's basically a full-fledged civilized nation in Egypt by the time Abraham gets there, which mathematically speaking is only a few decades, after the Tower of Babel falls. And so we have this going from Tower of Babel where it implies all humanity is focused around. And then within a few decades, we have not just one, but nearly all the pyramids built in Egypt. Something seems off, right? Because it takes a long time to build pyramids. I've never built one myself, but if any of you want to try to build one, let me know. I'll videotape it. I'm not going to help you. He's the first half, right? I might bring a crane over. It takes a long time to build, right? They're not fast, especially by hand without like massive tools. And so one of the historians have noted, biblical historians have noted that the actual wording in our text is very specific enough to where it doesn't necessarily mean all humanity was centered around Tower of Babel. The way it's worded is their process, they were migrating. There were people, humanity was traveling or moving about. And some of them, or at least a portion of mankind, had stumbled across the Shinar Valley. And they said, oh no, we're scattering. Quick, let's build ourselves a city. That's what they decided to do. Well, why would they build themselves a city unless they were scattering? Because their reasoning for building the tower was the fact they were scattering, they wanted to stop the scattering. Well, they wouldn't build this tower, wouldn't come with that logical thought process unless people were actually leaving, like they were actually traveling. If everybody shows up this valley, all humanity's there. Say, okay, we're all humanity's here and no one wants to leave. Well, there's no reason to build a tower, right? There's no one wants to leave anyway. We're all happy and content. So clearly people were in the process or in the migratory nature. They were continuing on their move, which is exactly what God commanded. He ordered Noah, his sons, all the animals to scatter about and repopulate the world. So in fact, we look at this, at least I look at this, say, well, if I look at this in that perspective, mankind was, at least some of them, were obeying God's instruction to Noah. And some people, in this case, we have the descendant or the ancestry of the Babylon, Babylon rulers, which is Nimrod and a few other people there, as far as how they're ruling there, they said, we need to circumvent this God obedience to stop the process of moving. So we're talking people traveling over hundreds of years. And at some point in time, they say, okay, we all want to center ourselves around Babylon and build this massive tower, whatever the purposes are. People debate that, whether they want to, some theologians argued they wanted to fight God with the sword and go up to heaven to fight him, which I can't comprehend that in my head. Maybe somebody else can. Some said they wanted to make like a, this, it was supposed to be this massive temple of some God of something, whatever that was supposed to be. I don't understand all the reasons why this tower was built. It just was, okay? And people debate what that's supposed to be. But my point being that people were scattering about along this process, and the tower was there to prevent that. So some, I don't know how many, some appear to have probably left and already had left by the time the tower was being, besides that they conceived of this tower to be built. Hence, why when Abraham shows up to Egypt, we have this massive civilization with pyramids already built, because that's the timing wise, it's prior to Abraham's arrival. Most of the pyramids were already built by then. So it's okay, well, that doesn't happen in a couple of years. It's going to be, you know, generations go by for that to occur. So I'm suspicious that I think some people prior to the Tower of Babel had already left the area and had already migrated to some level. I don't know how far they went. I can't imagine that. I'm not that smart. But some people probably left before the Tower of Babel existed. Now, what about their languages? When God said, I want to confuse their languages, that just because they were not, just because all humanity was not at the Tower of Babel does not necessarily mean God could not change all humanity's languages. He can still say, okay, all you people in Egypt, you're now language number 47. Bam. Oh, okay. They all speak language 47. That's right. So people in Babel, you got, you know, all the various broken down. It's possible. I don't know. Those are arguments or discussions about what that means. What I do want to bring some attention to is the precipitous loss of life cycles. They shrink down really fast, right? So that's an interesting concept. And this has been brought up by Advanced Genesis people have talked about this as well in some of their discussions. That, well, so the flood, prior to the flood, the globe probably had a particular climate. I don't know what kind of climate it was. It had a climate of some form. Maybe it was warm, it was cold. I don't know. It was something. And so, and the flood occurred, a lot of things changed. All waters of the place is probably relatively warm because it was out of the earth and then it kind of cools down. Things happen, right? Well, as people migrate, they migrate to areas that they're not necessarily born at, right? If you were born one place and you migrated from this part of the world to that part of the world, well, you weren't born in the new place. You were born in the old place. So the physical strain on our bodies change as you, if for example, my family, we moved here, Wyoming from California, right? Well, California and Wyoming climates are different. We get a lot of more snow here, a lot more freezing temperatures compared to where we lived in California. So life is a little bit different. And so the strain on your body is a little bit different. And that could have contributed to some of the significant decrease in lifespans. As we have this listed in our chapter 11, the quickly dropping from, you know, in the 900-ish year range, dropping down quickly into the 150s. Right? That's a huge drop. I do realize there are many generations here. We're talking 10 generations go by, but there's still a lot of generations and it does drop. And so my suspicion is there's probably a strain on their bodies, a more strenuous lifestyle or more difficult lifestyle how their bodies are handling. We also see that in the fossil record, we have animals that are much, much, much bigger in the past than they are today by huge margins. The one that always baffles my mind is the dragonfly. They had dragonflies that had wingspans of 30 inches. it's 2.5 foot wingspan. That's a massive dragonfly. And they had a whole bunch of fossils like that. But, yeah. Exactly. You imagine how loud, yeah, because they're pretty loud now flying around like stuff like drones. But imagine the size of when they were, you know, a 2.5 foot wingspan flying around. And I don't know what they ate, but they ate a whole lot of it. So, I can't explain the reason why, but clearly their physical size has shrunk from its massive bigness years and years and years ago. I'm assuming it's prior to the flood. I'm not sure it's that size immediately after. I don't know. But going down to its, you know, the ones they like, you know, 3-inch wingspan is pretty good size dragonfly. There's a few of them that are 4, but most of them are that ballpark range. So there's huge differences in both, obviously our biblical record on lifespans, and we have obviously physical record in fossils that life was just, our climate was just different prior to the flood. I don't know all of it about it. I'm not that smart, but there are definitely differences in how that was supposed to work. So we have these changes in humanity in both its location, migrating from wherever Noah's Ark landed. I realize the Mount of Ararat, people debate where that's physically at, into the Shinar Valley, and then going all over the place of the world. Obviously, we have the migrants that traveled up into Europe and down to Africa, and all these various nations, various countries. Life changed, strain was higher, life was more difficult on some of their bodies, and hence, I think, is probably why some of these people died younger and younger as they were trying to go along. So let's go back a little bit to this idea of trying to prevent people from migrating. So we adjusted their ages and the biology stuff and the movement of people. Okay, that's fine. Why do you think, to answer, just think about it for a minute. Why do you think a group of people would conceive of the idea to prevent people from scattering? So a set group of people, I don't know how many there were, a set group decides, we as a people don't want everybody else to travel and go and move around, right? What would be the instinctive objective? Let's imagine you are those people of this group making this decision. What would be your objective? Or what could be your objective on why you would want that to not take place? Let's think about it for a minute. Now, to me, I have a particular bias, so I can't tell you whether I'm right or wrong. It's just my bias on this. So I look at human beings and I assume they want power and control. That's just what I assume. I assume everybody wants power and control over everything they have no power, have no control over. We want to control everything that we don't have control over. So that's my bias, Daniel Agee's bias perspective. And so I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm suspicious if it is true, then these individuals who are making the decision to make this tower, they're trying to prevent the loss of that power and control. Because, mind you, I can say with words, I have power and control of the whole globe. Okay, I can say the words, but does that actually mean it's true? Of course not. That's ridiculous. I have no power of anything. So I can say stuff, but now let's say I never said the words, I have power and control of the whole world, but the entire world comes to me and says, Daniel, you have power and control over all of us. Now, I didn't say the words, but that actually physically happens then in that case, right? That scenario, that hypothetical scenario. So when a person's after power and control, they're actually after power control of other people. That's what it means. I can power and control, the pen in my hand. Okay, that's fine. But power and control of other human beings is a big drive for humanity. Governments live off of that. Predators live off of that. A lot of people live off of that, the power and control of the people. So when we deal with power and control, that's a problem that humanity tends to drive or go toward. Now, who actually has power and control? Our God does. He's the one who acts by God. He said, scatter, multiply. And the people are saying no, or some people are saying no. Don't scatter, don't multiply, stay here, stay with us and under our thumb, so to speak, under our power. So it's almost like even in the fact that then, I don't know if they were trying to build the tower to fight God or not, that's a theological argument, that seems ridiculous, that's okay. But they are successfully fighting against God's instruction, aren't they? So if God says do A and I say do B, I'm trying to resist God. If God says stop doing B but do C and I say no, don't do C, keep telling B, whatever it is, if I'm always going against God, I'm his adversary. We have Hasatan, the Satan, the devil, right? The idea of adversary. Anything I go against what God says or whatever instructions guide me, I'm trying to fight a battle or go against him. So regardless if this tower was supposed to be successful in keeping people constrained or not, the idea of going against God is its ultimate core. That's how I view it. I could be wrong, that's my biased opinion. So in that core, that desire to go against God, I think is one of the reasons that God helped along or assists along or helps the process of people dying younger. Because the longer life you live, the longer time you have to conceive and construct more elaborate and more successful control over people. So I think it's not necessarily just because their lives got more difficult, hence their lives got shorter. I think God said, yeah, we actually want their lives to be shorter. Tamara, you have a comment? Go ahead.
Power goes two ways. On the one hand, like you said earlier, you can proclaim yourself the king of the United States. Means absolutely nothing unless the people come alongside you and agree with you. So you can have people who are very charismatic and very amiable and very outgoing, and they can attract people to them. But the people also have to be willing to be attracted and to be submissive to that control. So not only are, you know, in our world, we have plenty of people who want to have power, but we also have people who want other people to have power over them because they don't want to make decisions. They want to be able to basically give that to someone else, give somebody else that control because they don't want to have to deal with the consequences if they're wrong. They could just blame somebody else if it goes wrong, right? So it's a two-way street.
Exactly.
So you think with Babel, when they came together, there probably was some sort of charismatic figure who was able to organize the people and to keep people on track to build this large ziggurat, to build this large tower, mountain, however you want to put it. So there probably was somebody there to organize everything who had the power, who the people gave the power to, but the people gave their power to this person to control things. So it's a two-way street. And so God is not only saying, no, I don't want there to be one person having control over everyone. I don't want these people to give their power to somebody other than God. So this Hasatan, if you will, small h, you know, he's trying to break all of that up. And this, and I was reading earlier that this ziggurat or this, they're basically these people were making a fake mountain. Because you read throughout the Bible that mountains are considered, or the Bible calls them high places. So these people were trying to make a high place to commune with the spirits or commune with something other than God.
Yeah.
So there is a spiritual component to this rebellion. It isn't just a matter of earthly power, political power that they are trying to do here. It's there is a big spiritual component to them. They are obviously rebelling against God. They know darn well they're rebelling against God. And God, soon enough, puts into it.
And I don't disagree with that principle. I do think the people themselves, I agree, the people themselves have this desire of willing to give away this instruction, this power that was supposed to allocate to them. They want to give responsibility away. And I'm not disagreeing that, I agree that also there's some spiritual component that they're doing. I don't fully understand. It wasn't there, obviously. I don't fully understand of how that works because I'm not that smart when it comes to the high places and how they're supposed to work. I don't really study them that well, but there is some spiritually that I don't fully comprehend. I do think that there's a spiritual realm in the form of like angel, demon, whatever. There's probably an influential factor playing in this role. And I bring that up because I think this is now my opinion again. I think that it's possible when God says, let us go down and confuse the languages. He's talking to all his various angels because and somebody has to be in charge of the language, right? Much like we have angels or spirits in charge of different nations and such. Well, somebody's been in charge of these languages. Okay, you know, angel number whatever. You got language 47. Go over and hang out in Egypt, right? So you have your language. Make sure it's the comprehension level is there. So I'm suspicious that there's, if he's doing that, if that is the case, which you may not be, there is a case of angels are hanging around or helping God in this compassion, then there are demonic influences they're also playing out here too, I think, in the Tower of Babel. I don't understand all of them. I don't have to, but there's some weirdness that's going on. And I think that's one of the reasons, again, my opinion, that God helped or desired the shortening of lifespans and what they accomplished. I know that there's I call it weird theology. Weird theology, but prior to the flood, about human beings being like some magical powering things that could do magical stuff. I don't necessarily agree with that. I'm right. I just don't see that. They could have been. I'm not around. But if there is some kind of spiritual realm going on, some spiritual aspects they're trying to incorporate or facilitate in this tower, they could have been. That's totally possible. I don't understand enough of it. What I do find interesting about the reduction in lifespans as well as the physical shrinking of critters and animals about God, that God did after the flood. One of these I want to bring to your attention to, which this got me into hot water a couple of years ago, but I'm going to do it anyway because it's fun. I like hot water. So you'll notice in our book, it has, people die, right? They live, they have kids, they die. Live, have kids, they die. Yada, 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 all down the road. So this I find funny, not funny as haha, it's funny as interesting, because this is highly controversial within inside Jewish rabbinical teachings. So you have a Terah, I'll write his name up here. Terah, oops, T, is it A-H? I think it's A-H. A-H, right? So Terah, he has three kids, right? He has Haran, he has Nahor, and he has Abram. So, oops, that's an M. So these are his three boys. And the way it's worded here, it says he's 70 years old before he has these three kids. So he has these kids around the age of 70. I don't know how many wives he had. Based on our biblical record, it appears at least two, because Abraham says he and Sarah have the same dad but different moms. So he has at least two wives, but I don't know how many more he had. Maybe he had three. I don't know. He had wives. So many wives he had. And of course, while they're still in Ur, Haran, his son, one of his sons, dies. Now Haran has Lot. He has three kids. He has Milcah. He has Lot. I don't know their ages. He has Iska. I think it's A-S-C-A-D. It's A-H. I maybe have spelled these girls down. I remember. So he has two daughters and one son. And then after he has these kids, Haran dies while still in Ur of Chaldean territory. And Nahor, he marries Milcah. So he marries his niece down here. So Nahor and Milcah they wind up having the kids with, they have, that's where Rebecca comes from. So Rebecca comes from Nahor and Milcah's line. That's where her life comes from. Lot, of course, hooks up with Abraham and takes off. Abraham marries his half-sister Sarah, or Sarai at this time. Jewish theology questions whether Sarai and Iska are the same person. I don't know if they are or aren't. It's opinion thing, whatever. So they may be the same thing. What I found interesting to me is that after Haran died, Terah takes Nahor, Abram, however many kids Haran has, Abram's wife and such, and he takes off. They move to the town called Haran. I can't say the town's name to his son. It's just coincidence. We move to another town and they call it to Haran. Now Terah winds up dying there. But what's interesting to me is that Terah doesn't die for a long time from now, from this point in the story. So Abram, Sarai, and obviously Milcah and Nahor stay there in Haran, but Lot, so at least these three individuals, Abram, Sarai, and Lot, they leave. Terah's still alive. Terah doesn't die and then they leave. They leave and Terah's still around. So they leave dad, they leave the family. Okay, so long, catch you guys later. We're going off to Canaan. So they leave. In fact, Terah stays alive all the way until Isaac is about 35 years old. That's when Terah actually dies, according to our biblical records of ages. So Isaac's grown adult. And mind you, 5 years later, Isaac marries Rebecca. But what I find interesting, why this is so controversial, why Jewish people argue about this in their texts, is that Abraham doesn't go back to bury his dad, Terah, because Isaac's not allowed to leave Canaan. Abraham tells his servant when he goes to find Rebekah, Isaac's not allowed to leave. So when Terah dies, we have a record here of him dying, much like most things in the Bible discusses stuff, but then kind of goes back in time and does more detail. So in this story, Abram does not go back and bury Terah like a normal son would have done. And Judaism has argued that that was disrespectful. It did not honor his dad, did not honor his parents. Like you should honor your parents when they die, all that kind of good stuff. And so, and Lot, of course, didn't go back either. So no one ever goes back and buries Terah. So Terah just dies. Was that? Nahor stays with Terah. So Nahor could bury him, which is fine. And I have no problem with that. But I find it interesting because in this context, this is where, which we'll get to, well, technically it's not part of this Torah portion. It's a different Torah portion. We'll get to later. some of the time. But in this context, this is where the controversy was. This is how I got hot water a couple years ago. was the argument about Messiah telling the man who said, "I'm going to follow you." Messiah says, "Well, the man says he has to go bury his dad first," and Messiah tells him, "Let the dead bury the dead." And the argument was, "Well, that's disrespectful. See, Messiah ordered a man to dishonor his parents; he broke one of the commandments." I got in this argument saying that's ridiculous. It's not a breaking of the commandment, but it was a, to say the least, the conversation argument didn't end well. Okay. Just it ended poorly. So I disagree with them at the time. I still do. Burying your dad is not necessarily a sign of honor. It can be, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's dishonorable, but that's not the measuring tool that we use to measure honor your parents. What is the measuring tool we use to measure honor our parents? What did God say a measuring tool is? Well, what do you do? What is your behavior? What are you matching? How are you living your life? That is how the measuring tool is used to honor your parents. What kind of person are you? Show that they raised you correctly. When God selects Abraham later on, says, "Hey, I'm going to choose you and all your descendants," because God explains, because you're going to teach your children to follow me. You teach them. And these children will, okay, not all of them do, but they're supposed to follow God along the rest of their lives. That was the idea. So honoring your father and honoring your mother is not tied into necessarily about burying them. I'm not saying that's wrong to do. Don't be wrong. I'm not disagreeing with the concept of it. But that's not the measuring tool God's using to honor your parents. The measuring tool is, what do you do? What is your behavior? What is your action? So in Abraham, his obedience to God is the actual honoring of his dad. I know that Judaism argues about Terah and everything else, but I find this interesting. To me, it's interesting because it's not the bearing of your parent that decides whether you honored them or not. It's how you lived. So the case of Moses, right? His boys didn't bury him. And even Aaron, his son, didn't bury him either. God took care of both those two men. So not everybody gets buried by their kids, and that somehow their kids are dishonoring them. They're not dishonoring them. They're just, God says, "Hey, you're doing something else different." The burying part is not, say, wrong, but it's not the measuring tool for honor. It's your life choices, the measuring tool for honor, how you live your life, which Abraham, his life, of course, is obedience. Big faith obedience is what he's talking about. So basic was, oh, so what was that, Isaac? Right. So he says, what parent would want their child to stop doing what is good and right, go bury them, and then return and to do what's good and right? Every parent, I know, forget me, I'm dead anyway. Go do the right thing. Every good parent say, go do the right thing, regardless of what you think I need or don't want. So the idea is that basically Abraham leaves Terah. Terah lives there 60 years after Abraham and Sarai leave, before he actually dies. So a lot of time lapse happens at what Terah lives in Haran and produces a life there and whatever else they do. I do realize Terah is recorded as an idol worshiper, not a maker. I know it's traditionally he made idol. The Bible, of course, is an idol worshiper in the book of Joshua or Judges. I think it's Joshua. But so he would have probably taught his kids some who knows what theologies. I'm not worried about that. God chose to pull Abraham out of that. So Abraham obviously does not follow the idol worshiping theologies that it appears to both that Rebecca's family did. So we have Laban later on, who he's an idol worshiper. He has gods and such, and has a whole argument. So Terah's idol worshiping didn't stop all of a sudden. He continued on whatever that was. And that's where Jewish theology comes along and say, well, that justifies Abraham's dishonoring of his dad, because his dad was still an idol worshiper. Okay, whatever. You can justify it however you want. The point is, Abraham left. 60 years later, Terah dies. But our Bible is not written chronologically, as we like to think. It's written in subject matter. So we discuss Terah's death here in this chapter. Then go back in time and discuss Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and all those things, stories about them. Even Terah's still alive, the story essentially is leaving Terah alone. We're done with that guy anymore. We're not going to talk about it anymore. We're moving on to something that's more interesting. So hopefully this made sense. I know it may seem esoteric to some level, but the idea of honoring your parent is life choices, what happens to your life, not about what you did to their dead body. Okay, that's I'm not saying you should abuse their dead body. My point is that it's not about the being there to bury them. It's about how you living your life. That's how you honor your parents, how you honor your father and mother. Hopefully made sense. But I move on, because now we get to talk about some stuff from our Haftorah portion, which ties into this. Okay, so let's move into the book of, let's see here. Nope, we went through that one. We'll jump to Isaiah 28. So I have to apportion from Isaiah 28, the first 16 verses or so. That's as it's recorded in our schedule here. So Isaiah 28, it's an interesting contrast. So Isaiah 28, this is different, or it's not completely unrelated to Genesis 11, but it has a different thread of thought process in Isaiah 28. So Isaiah 28, it's leading up, it's coming along after Isaiah 27. So 27 focuses more along the ideas of the God's attention and of the tribes themselves and their soon to be captivity. So the idea of 27 is talks about their coming captivity that's going to happen to them. And that's what Isaiah 27 talks about. And so it goes into brings our attention from that topic about, hey, doom and gloom is going to come. And now 28 leads into the idea of why is doom and gloom coming? So the prophets do this regularly as far as you have struggles, we're explaining what the struggles are, we're saying why they're happening and what you do to fix them. This is kind of a formula, so to speak. It's a warning here, you fix it. If you don't fix it, bad things happen. If you do fix it, good things happen. It's a pretty basic formula all the prophets really use pretty heavily. So in this one, we have Isaiah 28. Let's jump to Isaiah 28. I lost that bookmark. Man, hold on a minute. I've flipped to Isaiah 28 again. There it is. Okay. So Isaiah 28, it starts out, this is, woe the crown, pride of Ephraim's drunkards. This is my text. Your texts vary from translation to translation. The delight of his glory is a fading blossom, like a valley of oil upon the head of those battered by wine. Behold, my Lord has a strong and powerful wind, like a downpour of hail, destructive tempest, like a downpour of mighty surging waters. He will lay that crown to the ground with his hand. Okay, stop. So he's prophesying against the crown of Ephraim. So Ephraim, those of you who recall, so Isaiah, he lives in the southern section of Israel. So Israel here, we'll just draw Israel, Dead Sea, Galilee, you know, Israel, and the Mediterranean Sea is over here. So the basic map of Israel. So Isaiah is hanging out mostly in this southern section, the population area where Jerusalem's at. But he's sending his prophecy against Ephraim, which actually incorporates a large chunk of Reuben and Gad's territory. This whole section is, he's going to talk about, this is the area of Ephraim's control. Not that they own the whole territory, they don't. They control, they're the dominant player, the dominant tribe in that area. So this is what he's going to talk about, is who he's talking against. It's about the crown of Ephraim. Now, if you look at the kings of Israel, most of them weren't from Ephraim. Some were, but most were not. So it's not about this, say they're biological, like I'm the king or not king. We learned the crown of Ephraim. What is that? What is this crown he's talking about? Well, that's explained, even though it's talking about Judah at the time, it's explained down a few verses later. So if you jumped down, if you're not sure about it, in verse 7, which we'll get to a little bit, it says, verse 7, they've erred because of wine, they strayed because of liquor. The priests, it's talking specifically about Jerusalem or the southern tribes, but the concept is still the same. For the priests have erred because of liquor, they corrupted by wine, they have strayed because of liquor, and they've erred in their vision, and their perverted justice. So we have these basic crown. Ephraim's crown is pride. So what's he proud about? So we have this crown that God's discussing, crown of Ephraim, and it's based on pride. And how does that pride manifest itself? The same way it manifests itself in Judah. There's no difference. We have perversion of vision and justice. These destruction of these two things is an issue that God, that Isaiah talks about with Israel. It's the same issue that Ephraim has. They distort vision, distort justice. And what do you mean vision? It's information. What are you teaching about God? What information are we discussing? What's not being said versus what is being said? It's kind of like a spinning the information, like information for like the news. Oh, it's been spun. That's a good word. Misinformation. Political already. So vision is misinformation about God. That's really what it's focusing, what's going on. So that's where Ephraim's pride is. He's actually proud of the the injustice and distortion he does. And Judah's also proud of the same injustice and distortion they do. They're all proud of these dishonest evil dealings or wicked dealings. That's what we talked about here. So their way of life is twisted and distorted. So let's move forward here a little bit. Mind you, I believe that this is not that different from the Babel concept, right? And that God told you to do one thing and you choose willingly, defiantly, to do the opposite. Well, Ephraim and Israel were told to do one thing. They choose willingly, defiantly, to do the opposite. I'm not going to do what God said, I'm going to distort what God told you to do, and I'm going to distort the justice to make sure that the oppressed, you know, are oppressed more thoroughly. It's the same concept being applied. It definitely changes here. So let's move forward here a little bit. So we have in verse, we left off in verse, all right. Verse 3, trodden underfoot will be the crown of the pride of Ephraim's drunkards, and with the withering blossom, the light of his glory, that is like the valley of oil on his head, like a fig that ripens before summer, so as soon as the observer sees it, while it's yet in his hand, he swallows it. Like, what on earth does that mean? Okay, so let's, I'm going to erase by this thing, because I have other things to write up. I'll erase part of it. I'll erase my Mediterranean Sea. So, I mean, in this section here, we have, okay, so your pride, Ephraim. So Ephraim has a pride, and God likens it to a few different examples, but I'm going to choose one of God's metaphors here, the fig tree. So maybe this little fig tree, I know fig trees don't look like this, but that's okay. And they have figs on it. So we'll have little figs with a little stem out, right? It says, your pride is going to go away just like this. Someone, a man, woman, child, it's probably a child, because I did it as a kid. They're walking along and they see a fig tree that's ripe early. Any of you ever go to a fruit tree when you were kids and say, oh, the fruit will be ready. Like, for example, plums in our parents' backyard. Oh, they're ready in August and it's currently June. Well, that one's still green, but I see a speck of pink. I'll eat it now. It's got a whole month and a half to 2 months to go, but that's okay. It was the size of a pinhead, but I saw it. There was pink of that green plum. And I ate it, you know, go figure. And I ate the next one and the next one, a whole bunch of them. Okay. I didn't stop. Yes. So because someone coming along and see, it's not ripe yet. The things are ripe for like a couple months, but there's one that's there that's just slightly squishy, just a little bit squishy. It's ripe enough to eat. And they pick it and eat it. That's what I was talking about. You're proud to be that fig. The slightest hint that a person could possibly pluck your pride and crush it, they're going to do it so fast, it's instantaneous. And God said, that's how you're going to fall. So this pride you have, this wickedness, the crushing of it is going to be so thoroughly, it won't even be fully pride-filled, so to speak, fully ripe. It's going to be crushed before it's fully ripe. It's your pride is so wicked in God's eyes. So that's the metaphor he's using, which is pretty cool. I can understand these pictures. I'm not real smart, but pictures I understand. So I like the pictures. So that's what God's describing as far as how he's going to crush this pride and it swallows it immediately. So I did that as a kid. I'm sure some of you as kids probably did the same thing if you saw a fruit tree walking into school or whatever, or wherever you walk around. So in verse five. So on that day, the master of legions will become the crown of delight and a diadem of glory for the remnant of his people. So in the process of plucking this pride, so we're going to remove this fig. The child plucked the fig and ate it. So now in the process of removing it, this pride, this distortion of truth and distortion of justice, guys, I'm going to come along. I'm going to replace this pride crown that you have of yours. Based on this concept, I'm going to crush this or suck it away or have it eaten away. And then God becomes the crown instead. So basically he's telling them, I'm going to remove this pride of yours, become what should be there. The ideal God or the ideal crown that you should be proud about. Not proud about God. Because it says, and the spirit of judgment for he who sits in judgment is verse 6, and a source of strength for those who return from the war to the gate. So God's going to replace his pride of distortion of truth and the pride he has of distortion of justice with himself to fulfill truth and justice. So God's going to replace his pride with himself. He's going to do, right? Which we get that. It makes sense. In verse 7. For they too have erred. This is also discussing in the section of Jerusalem or Judah. Judas 2 has erred because of the wine and strayed because of liquor, as we read earlier. The priest, the prophet have erred because of liquor and were corrupted. So in this case, he said, this is what we're going to do, Ephraim. I'm going to pluck you out. I'm going to replace your crown, your pride with myself. And the exact same thing to Judah down here. So God's essentially going to say, I'm going to take both your nations. I'm going to suck away the pride of Ephraim, pluck it like until it's gone. Your wickedness and your evil is gone. Replace myself. Because just like you, we learn from all the other prophets the same thing, that Jerusalem or Judah did the exact same thing, followed the exact same footsteps that Ephraim did. So he's going to take this process. Your pride, Ephraim, is going to be sucked away and plucked away. Well, Judah, you have a pride also. You can talk about Judah as well. In the case of Judah's pride, they have the pride for the priests and the prophets. Now, priests and prophets, those are supposed to be good people. I mean, that's the idea behind them. Obviously, they aren't necessarily good. So, but the priests, what is their job? Obviously, to teach what is true and is right. That's a priest's job. And a prophet, they tell what God said. That's a prophet's job, to reveal what God is explaining. So these two have also followed the same route Ephraim has followed. And God said, if we take their crown away, I'm going to replace you all with me. So Ephraim's not alone in this distortion of truth and justice. The priests are also just as guilty, and the prophets are also just as guilty. I'm not saying every prophet. We're reading to Isaiah right now. But there are a lot of prophets in the Bible that aren't recorded, as far as they don't have books for themselves. I can't say they're all good or bad. They just are. So we have 11 people. So God's going to spread this concept around, not just to Ephraim, he's covered to all of Judah as well. So he's in both territories, both spaces, replaced with himself as this crown. Verse 8. So, air division justice. Verse 8. So for all tables are full of vomit, filth with no clean place. To whom shall one teach knowledge? To whom shall one explain a message? To those weaned from the mother's milk, removed from the breasts? And this is where we tie into our New Testament section, which we'll talk about that in a minute. But so he explains that, all right, priests, prophets, Ephraim, all these various people, who are you supposed to be teaching? Who is left to teach? Who's around still able to be taught? And he concludes, it's not the people. I mean, none of these adults. So God's saying, okay, I have a problem. You're supposed to be teaching what is true and what is right. Clearly, you're not. Who is left that's worthy or willing to listen and hear what God says? And he asks, is it the infant? That's what he's saying. The infant. They're left. Okay, so you had your adults, right? And now we have little kids. And God says, okay, I can't work with the adults here. They're not willing to listen. They're stuck with their preconceived ideas, their preconceived knowledge, their preconceived wisdom, what they think is right and wrong. I'm done with that. What's left? Well, at least the kids. Maybe I can teach the kids. Maybe I can teach the babies. He literally says the babies, ones weaned from the mother's milk. They're teachable. God's point. Is that all I have to work with? This is all that's left? Every other human being is not worth it, but the babies are left? That's what God's comparing this to. For it is command by commandment, line by line, a bit here and a bit there. So the methodology of teaching, which that's how you teach, piece by piece, right? That's what you have to teach. For unintelligible speech and another tongue, does one speak to this nation? Though he tells them, this is the truth is going to rest, give rest the weary. And this is a true satisfaction, yet they will not be content to listen. The word of Jehovah shall befall them by commandment, line by line, bit by bit, here by here, and so that they will go and stumble backwards and be broken and be tripped up and caught. So, point out that the teaching which should be happening to these adults isn't, they're not receiving the information. Because they're not receiving the information, only their kids, maybe God hypothesizes, maybe the child can receive it. Because the parents aren't going to receive it, the stuff that they're rejecting, the vision, the information they're rejecting, which is commandments, and like line by line, he explains, and then you have a little bit by bit, the little tiny bits of information that the methodology which you teach, here's a commandment, this is what it means, this is how you apply it, that's how you teach commandments. This information is not being heard to the parents. So maybe he can teach to the children, the infants. But even though if he could, he's going to condemn or correct the parents using the same commandment and line information against the parents to remove them. That's in explaining. So the same stuff you're refusing to listen to is the stuff that's going to destroy you because you refuse to listen to it. Hopefully it kind of makes sense. I don't know if it makes sense or not, but it makes sense to me. So you're rejecting the information. And so as a result of rejection, God will reject you with that same information. The same instructions will happen to you, but there is hope for that child, that infant that won't, that is still nursing or weaning, I should say, from their parents. Because if you pull a child from their child, from the parents that are weaned, they don't know very much, right? You could teach them from scratch. They can learn a whole lot. We do it in foster care system and adoption systems all the time, right? That's how that process is supposed to work, theoretically. Now, he points out that the stuff that we caught up and tripped in this, verse 14. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, O scoffing men, rulers of this people who are in Jerusalem. For you say, we have sealed the covenant with death and made a compact with the grave. When the surging staff of punishment passes through, it will not come to us. We have made deceit our shelter and taken refuge in falsehood. So that's a really long way of saying they're living like they made a deal with the devil. Okay. You have nothing to fear. So it's a bold statement, but it's just worded. Isaiah words it one way. In modern vernacular, we word it differently. We say, you made a deal with the devil. You have nothing to fear, right? The devil won't kill you. So the idea is being that the people themselves have this, they're living a methodology, living a lifestyle that is highly destructive to them. And yet they believe because God's with them. Nothing could possibly happen. God's on their side. He's not, by the way, but they think that. So therefore, they have nothing to fear. So God's put it, you're living like you made a deal with the death. But this deal of death you think you made, that God can't hurt you, no one's going to hurt you, we're all good, is actually in fact going to destroy you in the process. So this deal you think you made is not a deal at all. That's what God's essentially saying. I realize it's worded really weirdly, but that's because we use it in modern vernacular, which is different. We say, you made a deal with the devil. That's how we use it, the phrase. But he's saying, you made a deal with death, which isn't the same thing. You live this style of falsehood and deceit, which is going to crush you. Now, verse 16. Therefore, thus says the Lord Elohim, behold, I am laying a stone for a foundation in Zion, a sturdy stone, a precious stone, a sure foundation. Let the believer not expect it to be too soon. So he's pointing out that this stone will be sometime in the future. I'm going to do this. I shall use judgment as a measuring line, righteousness as a plumb. Hail will sweep away the shelter of deceit, and water will wash away the refuge of falsehood. Your covenant with death will be annulled, and your pact with the grave will not be binding. When the surging staff passes through, you will be crushed by it. Whenever it passes through, it will take you, for it will pass through every morning, by day, and by night. Understanding of this report will bring sheer horror to you. The mat will be too short and the stretching out and the cover too small for getting into. So nothing to protect you. So in this process of the methodology to use sometime in the future from Isaiah, he's talking at some distant time period, not sure when in Isaiah's time. We from our New Testament perspective, we know more information about this, but Isaiah didn't have that information. So we understand it as Messiah he's talking about. And Isaiah may have understood Messiah or not, meaning that he applied this passage. I don't know for certain that there's not enough information to text to know what Isaiah was thinking. But either way, Messiah's going to do this. Messiah's the one to actually make this process happen, this crushing process. We think of him being, the loving God. He is loving. And Messiah is obviously our king, but our king has a responsibility and obligation to do what is right. And so these adults who are not willing to change their behavior, they'll get crushed. Messiah will be the one who's crushing them. And that because they refuse to listen to or pay attention to this process. Totally kind of makes sense. So their deal with death is not going to apply. So I'm going to jump forward. I'm going to lose weight so far. Because a similar concept is being discussed about in 1 Corinthians. By the way, this foundation stone Zion thing, ladies, we have songs about that actually. One of our dance songs about that. Peter talks about this as well in 1 Peter. Paul talks about it a couple of different times in his references as well. About it's really basically about your mental and actionable behaviors. So when they focus, when Peter in particular focuses a lot in 1 Peter chapter 2 about this concept, as far as what the behaviors should be for these individuals, these adults, versus what the behaviors are. And he contrasts it and says, okay, we have a particular way of life that you're supposed to be obedient to. And he gives this example of, which is similar to what Isaiah just said, is that essentially, and when it comes to your actions, what you're supposed to be doing, be a childlike. You're supposed to be like childlike for good actions. You're actually based on, this is 1 Corinthians 14, for Paul says, it says this. You're actually a childlike actions, your way of viewing the world. But your comprehension, the commandment information, should be adult-like. So you have two responsibilities. Your actions are innocent in their nature. There's no harm, no evil intended in them. And yet, but your comprehension of God should be mature and very heavily adult-like in its understanding. That's what Peter's talking about as well in 1 Peter chapter 2. He discusses the exact, because he quotes this passage of Isaiah 28 in it. He talked about, this is what God is trying to tell us in through Isaiah. That's what he's trying to explain, is that if you want to be God's people, you have two responsibilities. You look at the world as a child look at the world, but you comprehend everything God's saying as an adult does. So you know a child, meaning you're not going to be harmful. Children are not considered harmful to people. You don't harm anybody. You don't cause detriment to people. But when you comprehend what God's saying, you better have a mindset. Okay, God, what are you doing? What's happening? What's the plan? And be aware as a mature adult views the world. So it's almost like two mindsets, so to speak, that Peter's arguing for. So in Paul talks about this as well to some level. He says you'd be a babe or a child, like in 1 Corinthians 14. Let's jump there real quick. Talking super fast, aren't I? Yeah, everybody's nodding. Yes, I am. Sorry. I get excited. I talk quick. It just happens. So 1 Corinthians 14, jumping down to verse 20, as John had read earlier. Brethren, do not be children in understanding. However, in malice be babes, but in understanding be mature. That's Paul's argument in this discussion. And the law is written, with men of other tongues, other lips, I'll speak for this people. Yet for all that, they will not hear me, says the Lord. Therefore, tongues are for a sign, not to those who believe, but the unbelievers. So now Paul's going into a nitty-gritty example of what he means about being a childlike babe versus being this adult. So let's pretend we've advanced past this point of Isaiah, or we get the idea we'd like to be like a child to some level in our nature, but not in our understanding of God. So let's go past. So we understand Isaiah. Okay, get it. I get it, Isaiah. Well, I'll stop being a child. I'll stop being a self-centered human being full of wickedness. So I'm going to have a basic principle. I have an adult. I comprehend there's supposed to be some level of understanding of God in this. And now he says, okay, now as an adult, this is Paul's discussion here, you have responsibilities. Now we have in which is the regular Haftorah portion in the book of Amos chapter 2 for today, discusses this nature of being a prophet and being a Nazarite vow, these good things you're supposed to be. So, and then Paul talks about these prophet issues that we have in his day in the Corinthian church. So we have these people, there's not one, there's a whole bunch of them, right? We have all these various people in this church, and they all want the same same effect, the same expression of God, right? They all are looking for, I'm a prophet, with a big P above their heads. I'm a prophet. No, I'm a prophet. No, I'm a prophet. They all have their two cents they want to say. And Paul's saying, this is messed up. You're not all the same. You don't all have the same gifts, the same intent, the same purpose. Just sit down and be quiet, all right? A few of you can talk. The rest of you just sit down and be quiet and listen to what's being said. So he's pointing out that in the child, does a child, in a childlike maturity, is a child going to be focused on trying to take the glory for themselves? Typically not. An adult will take the glory for themselves. Think Tower of Babel. A selfish, self-centeredness. I'll take the glory. Look at me, 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 me. And hence, that's he's pointing out, this is what you guys are doing. This is disgraceful. We don't do this. This is not how it's supposed to be looking. The same thing happens with speaking in tongues. Look what I can do, blah, 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 Tower of Babel. I can speak in 5 languages. I just learned them yesterday, right? Or 10. How many languages God made? A whole bunch of them. So that's not the point. That's self-glorification. These are disgraceful behaviors. These are not acceptable behaviors to God or in the church itself. So a child is not supposed to be focused upon self-glorification. Yeah, they may say, hey, look what I can do. Sometimes mommy and daddy look, I ride bike with no hands. The stuff they do. But that's not the point of it. We're not supposed to act like that. we're supposed to act like mature people who comprehend that, yes, there is information to me that God may have given, or information to you God have given, or to her, or to him, or to her. All these things God has given us stuff, and we can share them, that's fine, but not to our own glorification. Why? What would that do? It lifts us up, just like Tower of Babel would lift us up. Makes me in the place of how great I am. Look at my power. Look at my authority. Look what God did for me. Me, 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 me. So we're not the me's. So it's not about the me's. It's about the you's, the other people, the people who are in need of information and help or assistance. So in this storyline, we have our Genesis story, which is about Babel, and we have Isaiah's story about which we just talked heavily about, the whole the people themselves being not willing to hear information and not willing to change their behaviors. So you have a pride issue, as well as twisted behaviors on their pride issue in Isaiah. And then we have this New Testament section in 1 Corinthians talking about being childlike. That's a C, not a G. Childlike in our maliceness, but adult in our understanding, comprehension of God. So this essentially is our three themes happening inside our 3 year cycle tour portion. They're all based on the same principle of a self-focused individual. The Babel is focused on self-focused people, about the me, about how great I am, put us all together. Look at me, look how great my tower is. Look, I'm just like God. All those things that defy God, that sense of self-geared, pride-filled individual. And we have that the Ephraim story in Isaiah is also based on a self-pride-filled individual, that I don't need to hear God's words. I'll tell you what God meant to say, because God said this, and God didn't actually say that, but they say it anyway. And God wants you to do these things instead of what he said. You should come to me. I know more than God. Type of individual that's talked about in the case of Ephraim and the priests and the prophets. And then we have this child adult behavior that Paul is discussing, and Peter talks about too in 1 Peter, that there is a behavior of, you should have a better breath comprehension. Hope we didn't lose anybody on this. So all of them gear toward the same problem, because in this case, Paul argues that this is your supposed behavior, but he actually points out, you guys actually aren't doing that. You're actually reverting in chapter 14 of 1 Corinthians. You're actually acting more like these pride-filled individuals. That's what you're actually doing, instead of doing what you should be doing. So basically, it's all cored down to pride. It's how big, how great am I? The self-importanceness. And three-year cycles here, the self-importanceness is a real problem for all humanity. I run across it. We all run across it. We're all guilty of it. We think we're really important. And reality is, we're not. I mean, we're important to some level, but reality is, mankind is somewhat important to God. I know King David talked about that. But realize, we don't actually have any real importance to God in that capacity. If I tomorrow said, oh God, I'm done with you, yada, 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 walk away and he kills me, whatever, whatever he wants to do, or nothing, it's his choice. He can always replace me with somebody else. Okay, well, Joshua number one, he quit. Okay, number two, you're now up to place. I'm replaceable in God's view, in God's world. I can be swapped out. Well, we'll just put another person there. You want the job, somebody else did the job. It's not about the me, it's about the God. It's all about him, what he wants. So if I focus on the me, which is what the Tower of Babel talks about, this pride Isaiah talks about, and this also pride that Paul talks about, and the pride that 1 Peter chapter 2 talks about, if it's all about the me, there isn't room for God anymore. Being honest, there isn't. I may paste it, like color it with God on the outside, make it look like it's God, say it all in God's name. All I did was just paste the color of it. No, did I mention earlier when I started out saying, if I say I'm the king of the world, it doesn't make it the king of the world. It's just words. So I can paste it, make it look like it's all about God. And in fact, it's not. It's all about the me. And this is where our problem lies. The me is the problem. It's all about the me, and the me has to go away. The me has to shut up and sit down, as Paul said. Shut up, sit down. You have nothing to say. It's not important. It's not about the you. So that's kind of the core gist of what I'm going to talk about today, as far as this pride, self importantness. What's that word? Narcissist, the right word? Yeah, narcissist. Narcissist view of the world. And this is where God says, this is wicked. This is awful. This is difficult. And not only that, it's about, I can't work with this. It's God. And Isaiah says, it points out, not only is it bad, God saying through Isaiah, I can't actually work with this. This is non-functional. I have to get rid of it. I can't get past this self-importance pride issue is so just twisted and gross. I can't handle this. And God's, I'm going to get rid of you guys. This isn't worth it to me. I'll start over again because you aren't worth it. I'll start over with the infants. I have to get rid of this self-importance. As opposed to we think, oh God, just fix it. His method of fixing it is to get rid of you. So this narcissistic viewpoint or the self-importance viewpoint, how great am I? God's pointing out that you're not. I'm not. We're not. God may have a use for us as a function, but just like Terah, when his function was done, he wasn't done yet. He lived another 60 years. God says to Terah, essentially, I'm done with you. You did your job. You reached the age 70. You had three boys and at least one daughter. I'm finished. We're done. Bye, Terah. Moving on. Terah's function ended once Abraham was shut up. And God moved on to Abraham, or Abram. Self. Abraham has changed. Abraham gets named later. But God moves on. Your importantness wasn't that important, Terah. It just wasn't. And leading at the point where God talks to Abram, up to that point, it appears Abram's importantness isn't that important. Now that God says, now Abram, we're going to talk to you. Now you became important. And then once Isaac gets married, has kids, Abraham's story stops. Abraham's not dead yet, but his story stops. Because God says, Abraham, thanks. You're not important anymore. Moving on. next kid. We're talking to Isaac now and do with Isaac and Isaac's kids and everything else. So the story moves on. And then once Jacob takes off and flees to Laban, the story of Isaac essentially stops. Isaac lives like 50 years more. But we don't hear about him. Because God says, yeah, I'm done with you. It's not about you, Isaac. It's about what you did. The function you wrote, the role you played. That's what matters. The importance isn't about the you. It's about the task God assigned and how well you fulfilled that task. Once tax is done, it wasn't about you to begin with. It's about what God wanted you to do and what his goal was. Yeah, it's the agreement I made. That's what it's about. It's not about the you. We think the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's good. He is. But he has a time slot. You, Abraham, are going to do something in this time slot. This is important. When the time slot ends, you may still be alive. That doesn't matter. I'm moving on to the next time slot important thing. That's not about you. Not that God was cursing Abraham. He wasn't. He wasn't forgiving you or getting rid of him. We just don't hear about him because it wasn't important anymore. The topic moved on, so God moved on. It was the message that the obedience mattered. That's what the core was. Not about the men themselves. So I can talk about Terah or Abraham or Jacob or Moses or Noah or any of these guys. And Noah lived for like hundreds of years after the flood. We don't hear about him anymore. He's done. Once the flood happens, ark's done. Noah's like, yay, here's some animals. Burn them up, and now we're done. Right? He lives for hundreds of years, but no one cares. Doesn't matter anymore. The storyline ends. So it's not about the individual themselves, the self-pride, the self-importance, the narcissist behavior, the Tower of Babel mentality. It's about the actions of the individual. What are you doing? Did you fulfill what God said to do, or did you not? If you don't, we don't hear about you. Go on. Yeah, ground him in. Korah, ground him up, you're swallowed, you're done. Okay, we're moving on to somebody who will listen. So, did I lose anybody on this concept? Hopefully I didn't. This is kind of what I wanted to talk about in this three-year cycle. A portion or a variation of this is also, again, I can't say it's coincidence, I don't think it is. It's the one-year cycle also talks about the similar topic in the Haftorah portion as well as the Torah portion with Joseph. So it's I don't think it's coincidental. The three-year cycle, one-year cycle happen. We talk about the same discussion topic matter regardless of what year you're following. It was like, that's kind of cool.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.